Welcome, everyone. I'm Ellen Dunham Jones, your host of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. This is episode 27. Now, today, I am delighted to welcome Diana Lind and Andrew Bruno to explore the question, if you change the house, how does it change the city? I am very happy to be joined today by Andrew Bruno and Diana Lind. Andy just joined Georgia Tech as our newest Ventulette Next Fellow. An architect, before moving to Atlanta this summer, he worked in the design department of the New York City Housing Authority. His experience with public housing and public space was rewarded with the Institute for Public Architecture's 2020 Fall Fellowship. It's perhaps his redesign of the private house, and I put that in quotes, that has gained the most notoriety. He created an Instagram page called One House Per Day and posted a unique design of a detached house each day in 2020. Celebrated in numerous architectural venues, the 365 drawings have just been published. I am also delighted to welcome Diana Lind to Georgia Tech. She became the editor-in-chief, then executive director of Next City, a leading urbanist website and nonprofit based in Philadelphia. It remains a terrific resource for innovative, socially responsible programs and projects. But she went on to serve as a founding advisor to the New Cities Foundation and is currently a director with the Penn Institute for Urban Research. I've invited her to kick us off today by referencing her 2020 book, Brave New Home, Our Future in Smarter, Simpler, Happier Housing.
Thank you so much for having me. I am author of a book called Brave New Home that came out in 2020. Really explores the history of single family housing, alternatives to it, and new ideas around housing policy that could help us create better communities and better housing. The general idea that I want to put forward here is that we live in a country of essentially one size fits all housing. And that is problematic. It's problematic to live in a country where the dominant housing type, the overwhelmingly dominant housing type, is single family homes. It's important to recognize that we didn't always live this way. It wasn't always that way, nor should we continue to live this way for a variety of social, economic, and environmental reasons. A lot of people think about the single family home as being sort of a birthright of the United States, a kind of given here. Certainly, Ellen referenced the American dream. I know we're going to talk about that, but this idea that is so ingrained in American society that we are a country of single family homes with white picket fences, and that this is the way that it's always been. But it actually really wasn't always this way. We were really originally a country of dense urban areas with people living in a variety of different housing types that I think are worthy of some reflection, discussion, and kind of fresh eyes. So the slide that I have here is a picture of a boarding house in Tacoma, Washington in the 1800s. And in front of it are about 30 of its residents or so. And it's essentially two twin houses that today would probably house somewhere between 4 and 8 people. And certainly we could agree that, 30 people or so in this space is too many. I would also contend probably 4 is too few. Boarding houses were a very common way in which Americans lived in the 1800s. And in urban areas, about half of city dwellers either were boarders or had housed boarders. So it was a super common way. And it was a very efficient way for people to move to U.S. cities, be able to access their work, walk to work, live affordably, make connections, and to really access housing in a way in which you could kind of imagine today is pretty unthinkable. There were a lot of different other housing types that were really prevalent prior to the World Wars. So I'm showing some images of apartment hotels, which were a popular housing style, kind of especially around the turn of the 20th century, when apartment hotels were seen as a way for people to access the city. And in a way, it was sort of a progressive feminist housing type. Families, couples, single people could live in apartment hotels. They could eat in public dining rooms where there would be social activity. Women would sort of be separated from their domestic responsibilities at the time because apartment hotels offered not just, you know, food in the dining rooms, but also cleaning, laundry, et cetera. And this is a style of living that was quite some time people living in kind of more extended stay hotel situations, and really ended up being zoned out more in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in a lot of urban areas. There are a lot of housing types that were that you probably recognize in and around the places that you live. These are some pictures of two flats that were very common in Chicago. And these were duplexes. It was a great housing type, particularly as people were trying to find ways to, say, have a little bit of privacy, but live near their relatives. You could live in one apartment and your parents or your children could live in the other one. It was also a great way for people to build equity, living in one apartment, renting one out. These kinds of duplexes also have become very difficult to find, in terms of zoning in the U.S., very difficult to build. And in many cases, in a lot of cities like in Chicago, they're actually a threatened housing type because a lot of the existing two flats are being turned into single family homes because those are more easier for developers to sell and more expensive and lucrative. I think a lot of that history has been sort of forgotten, as a lot of people, when you talk about, you know, the ways that people lived in cities, it gets kind of collided with these images of, say, how the other half lives. This is an image from Jacob Riis's very famous book that exposed, rightfully so, the undignified and unsafe and unhealthy living conditions of people in overcrowded urban areas. At the end of World War I, a kind of government-led campaign that was amplified by media to really kind of encourage people to own your own home, live in privacy, live with your own backyard, and to have that kind of economic stability of owning your own home. A lot of people grew to feel that if you didn't own your own home, you were somehow threatening your family, that you weren't doing your part as a parent, that you were kind of doing something that was unhealthy even. There were a variety of different tools that that the government produced over the coming decades to really encourage owning your own home. So certainly the kinds of financial tools like the mortgages that came out of Depression era that enabled returning veterans from war to access housing, and just a much broader swath of the American population to access housing. And it really encouraged home ownership in the US. But as you can see from this picture here, this is a graph showing the home ownership rate in the US. It was very successful in promoting home ownership. And that's certainly something that I think a lot of people say, hey, this was great that the US was able to get so many people to be homeowners, to go from, about 40% of the U.S. population to over 65% being homeowners. But the truth is that that homeownership really wasn't widespread across the U.S. This is an image of how racial covenants in Minneapolis segregated that particular city. And certainly the combination of racial covenants that went along with the sale of single family homes and that kind of home ownership that really, even to this day, has been in some ways kind of reserved for the white population in this country, that, you know, all these various different factors have really kind of shown that home ownership is not the kind of widespread positive that sort of popular culture tends to think of it as. Even in majority Black cities, there is a double digit home ownership gap between white and Black populations. And so now we're in this very strange situation where over the past 50 years, the average housing size has, you know, nearly doubled. Meanwhile, the average household size has started to really decline. So we have, you know, something like 2.5 people living in close to 3,000 square feet nowadays. And it's really, you know, when you look at that family of seven and those how the other half lives, it's really kind of the pendulum has swung in a completely different direction. And there are a lot of kind of social, economic, and environmental challenges that come with that. Certainly the economic challenge being that housing at that price per square foot rate is really expensive. When you have houses that are on single, you know, on an acre or even half acre lots, that doesn't allow you to have the kind of density of commercial activity and kind of the urban core that you might end up having in a neighborhood that has lots of different housing types in it. And that can create social problems. Here's a slide about how loneliness is more dangerous than obesity and as bad as smoking cigarettes. There's really this mismatch ultimately between that style of housing and the population that we have today. So we have a much more diverse population than the 1950s population that we had. Nowadays, we're seeing a consistent increase in multi-generational living, so which is much more prevalent among people of color than it is among white families. And we're seeing a mismatch between there's this huge population that wants to live multi-generationally, needs to live multi-generationally, and it's kind of banging up against the single family housing type. We also have a younger generation that is just vastly different than it was in the 1950s, much more focused on experiences rather than things, much less likely to get married, to have much more likely to have children much later in life, have smaller family sizes. And so when you start to look at all these various different aspects, you start to wonder, why are we still building this single family house that was really kind of predicated on ideas of family over a century ago, that it's not conducive to, say, you know, the digital nomads of today, or people who might, you know, be married, then decouple, recouple, all the various different kinds of households. So what does that American dream look like now? This is an image from a developer out on the West Coast called United Dwelling, which will build you an accessory dwelling unit in your backyard in exchange for a portion of the rent, right? So the American dream for a lot of people might end up being having a rent-producing property on their property. It's not necessarily just having that privacy in that big backyard. Co-living has emerged as a trend, particularly prior to the pandemic, and I really start to see it kind of becoming much more a part of the conversation again nowadays. But increasingly, as people are trying to find ways to connect with people socially, co-living is a really great opportunity for people who are moving to cities that kind of want that almost experience of that like boarding house, but in a way that's more stylish. And instead of kind of paying for more space, you're paying for more amenities and social experiences. It might look like much more purpose-built multi-generational housing. So this is a project near Tucson, in Tucson. So even getting down to that very, you know, niche category of grandparents raising grandchildren and looking at, you know, what are some of the different design elements here that would really kind of appropriately value this particular demographic? It would be, you know, if you're going to have a two bedroom, requiring that there are two bathrooms, which is not the way that a developer would build, say, you know, a typical two bedroom, but it's really important to grandfamilies, to grandparents, to have, you know, their own separate bathroom from young children, or to have it have sort of universal design elements so that both younger and older people can access the space in a certain way, or to have, you know, there are some images here of these little shutters which can open and close. So to create your patio that's nice and private, but open if you want to connect with your neighbors as well. And I'll end with this slide here, which is an image from a, you know, major developer, I think it was a Lennar floor plan for a new style of housing, which is their next gen model, which includes, you know, what they call their next gen living room and bedroom. And it's an accessory dwelling unit that's built into this new single family home. And I really think, kind of segueing here into Andrew's talk, that the future of the single family home is one that is being tweaked to kind of accommodate these new demographic changes. And as we talk a little bit more about policies, that might be one of the fastest ways to kind of get to new styles of housing that better kind of accommodate people today. So I will stop there. And I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Diana. All right, Andrew, you're on.
My work that I'm going to talk about today kind of comes at it from the approach of those problems having been solved. I'm really interested in the way in which the house has kind of historically been used as a tool for architects in America to communicate with broader publics. So the kind of ideal of the cottage house detached in an idyllic suburban landscape was actually kind of really helped in its infancy by architects like Andrew Jackson Downing, who used a very specific mode of representation, the kind of vignette coupled with more traditional architectural orthographic drawings, to depict this kind of idyllic way of life that living in a small cottage house would entail. And I think that there's something really interesting in that, in the sense that architects have kind of lost our ability to communicate with broader publics. My project that kind of responds to that is called One House Per Day. And it's a project in which the year 2020, for every day I drew a different detached house. So there are 365 total houses. And basically every day I would post a different house on Instagram. And the project has since expanded. I just don't have the juice to still like be drawing a house every day. And so I've expanded it to encompass different guest authors who bring different ideas to the table. But the basic proposition is a kind of low stakes daily meditation on how the house as an architectural typology might expand to, transcend the strictures that are currently placed on it by things like zoning or its need to accommodate only the single nuclear family. There's intense possibility within the architectural form of the house to accommodate, different sorts of family structures or different types of kind of social arrangements, but also the ability to provide space for different types of use. So this is a house in which a kind of large central workspace is flanked by a number of different private rooms for sleeping. But notice that the workspace has seating for far more people than could actually live in the house. And so there's an idea here about kind of opening the territory of the house to encompass the kind of transient occupation by more than just the number of people that live there. You just can't buy a small house anymore. That like, if you're one person or two people, you might want to live in a house, but you might not want a 1500 square foot house, which is about as small as you're going to get these days. And so there are a number of houses that are like this that are kind of stripped down to, four or five rooms. This house is maybe 400 square feet, but you can imagine a rich life taking place within it. Some of the houses are maybe a little bit less earnest than others. So one of the kind of aspects of the current manifestation of the house is that it's built on, more than a century's worth of kind of emphasis on privacy, that privacy is kind of the highest ideal. And so a lot of the houses in One House Per Day kind of intentionally, sarcastically vibe in exactly the opposite direction. So this is one of my favorites. It's a little bit much for most people probably, but the idea is that there's actually no single wall hits the ground in this house, that the kind of different spaces within are implied by like super deep coffers in the ceiling, but you would always kind of like see your roommate's feet walking around and stuff like that. Or like this one, which is basically a 16 square matrix of rooms in which there's just this giant amorphous bed that takes up like the entire floor area. So these are kind of like more intellectual kind of riffs on the opposition to our like intense focus on privacy. But a lot of the houses are kind of more earnest, like this one that is very much in the sort of ADU territory. And I would definitely, have the caveat that like I'm skeptical of the current ADU craze as a sort of like, permanent solution, in as much as it has the potential to kind of create this permanent underclass, either you're in the main house or you're in the ADU. And so this is maybe like a 300 square foot house, but you can imagine that because it is sort of planned efficiently, it has the potential to provide a kind of rich condition of inhabitation for one or two people. On the somewhat more extreme end of things, this is like, the real minimum, where like each room is so small that you need to get into it from the outside. Some of the houses are kind of more like explicitly sort of, communal. So if some of the less earnest houses that we saw before kind of really turn our conceptions of privacy on its head, houses like this similarly really emphasize large collective spaces, but acknowledge the reality that for communal living to really work, there needs to be the possibility for absolute privacy. So this is kind of a collection of cells, sort of like private monk cells that are all arrayed along this like very, very large communal space that kind of has everything that a single person might need. Some of the houses try to explore different tactics for imagining how people with different sizes or abilities might be accommodated by the architectural material of the house in opposition to the kind of one house, one size fits all issues that Diana is identifying. So this is a house in which the openings between rooms are all at different sizes. So the way that an adult might move through this house is different from the way that like a child or a pet might move through it. And I'll close with this one because it kind of combines a number of those things. So this is a house that is kind of like, the classic four square, provides space for one or two people, but also incorporates workspace that goes beyond the kind of, traditional home office that might be allowed by current zoning, to imagine that this might be a house in which like the person that lives there has a small office with a few employees that can come here to work. So I want to close by just emphasizing that, though architects don't often, want to deal with the house super earnestly as a kind of like valid object of study or speculation or reflection. And so we saw this tendency in the 2020 presidential election for the political right to kind of demonize the idea of eliminating single family zoning as the Democrats are out to abolish the suburb. And I think that we all kind of know that's not true. We're just trying to imagine how they might be made to be more diverse. And finally, I'll just note that the insanity in the housing market right now has become so extreme that normal people or non-architects are kind of starting to think about this for a lot of people, probably the first time, but mostly because you just can't avoid it anymore. So I think that it's a really opportune and fertile time for architects to be speculating on how this typology that is so ingrained in American culture might be made to do more.
Thank you both. Have we gotten to the point where now the desire for community and communal spaces, is this being kind of driven by we've succeeded too much in achieving privacy? Or is it just plain household size has gotten smaller and it's just demographics or destiny? Diana, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, community used to be your household, right? For many people, if you had seven people in your household, you probably would never be bored, just hang out with the folks in your house. So I definitely think that now we're at a point where our population, 25% plus of the population lives alone. So if you are living alone, you're probably going to be seeking community somewhere else. And for a lot of people, online provides one option, but I think a lot of other people are trying to figure out, how can they find community in other spaces? But at the same time, then you've got this challenge in a lot of cities where, those third spaces have also become kind of boring in a certain way. Like even if, coffee shops were really cool in the 1990s, they're not really anymore in the 2020s as much so. And I think that kind of desire to figure out, well, couldn't there be some way that my house could be somehow more communal, I think is really attractive for a lot of people. The barrier is that it doesn't exist in so many places. I mean, I can't tell you how many people who have told me about their fantasies of living in some kind of, way closer to their friends or their family, but it's just not an option in so many places. And so, what I wanted to show with the book and talk about today is this actually did exist at some point. we could do it again. We could, it's a duplex is a community in many cases, just off the bat, you know? I think that I'm looking forward to the conversation, the back and forth on ADUs, but there are many pros and cons there, but so many cases that is also about, for many people, a community of some sorts. And those kinds of, you know, more interesting creative options, like whether it's co-living apartment hotels or different housing types that are, you know, back in the day, there used to be housing specifically for sailors or typists or, you know, young women moving to a city or whatever else. These kinds of things have fallen out of favor, but I think that a lot of people would be really game for them if we found the ways to bring them back.
The housing for particular types and apartments in Atlanta is actually kind of was one of the several ground zeros, but of the swinging singles apartment complexes in the 70s.
Right.
I mean, it was the first time women, it was considered okay for women to, previously women were expected, you live at your father's house and then you live at your husband's house.
Right.
And this introduction of that there was a sort of in between there that was absolutely social. And,
you know, when you see, for example, the kind of like more sort of commune oriented houses that I just showed, those are kind of reacting to the possibility that like we might just never have more diverse, like kind of overall urban patterns in our suburbs. And like, how can you maybe start to get that diversity, which has the kind of implication of maybe a slightly less degree of privacy, but you know, maybe just a sort of more pared down privacy within the kind of territory of the individual house. I mean, I guess the way that I would simplify is to say that like, there's not necessarily a problem with privacy. I think that privacy is really important. Everyone needs to have the opportunity to kind of like be totally alone sometimes. But the emphasis on like the entire, you know, 2000 square foot house as this bastion of privacy that is totally inviolable, I think is, you know, has had some really obviously negative consequences.
Well, all right. So to address those negative consequences, we're living in interesting times. We've seen some pretty interesting policy changes. Zoning and land use have historically always been seen as the purview of local municipalities, local counties, I mean, very locally dealt with. States, let alone the federal government, never sort of dared not step in. It was considered not their turf. And yet, since Minneapolis did away with exclusively single-family home zoning, California, Oregon, and Washington as states have followed suit. California is increasingly establishing state laws that supersede local laws when it comes to allowing affordable housing on commercial land or sort of allowing higher density if you include more affordable housing. So, you know, Diana, you document the real flood of ADUs that have appeared in California. I mean, I think I saw some recent statistics in Los Angeles. I mean, it was just the number of ADUs so exceeded that have been built just in the last 5 years, so exceeded the number of affordable housing units deliberately added to the market, or, you know, and exceeded the number that had been lost from the market through obsolescence. So it's not to say that all those ADUs are super affordable, but tell us more about what you see as the impact of these kinds of policy changes.
Yeah. Well, so I think that the statewide changes are really exciting because so many municipalities don't have the bandwidth or the capacity to implement or, you know, have those battles around zoning. And so having, you know, kind of statewide policies that trickle down to all parts of the state is really exciting, I think. And, you know, I can say in Philadelphia, even we had a battle over accessory dwelling units here and couldn't get the entire city to vote on having accessory dwelling units. And so it's now, you know, it depends on which council district you live in, whether you're able to, and it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, how can you actually develop accessory dwelling units if you can't do them across the region, you know, in which you're living in? How, you know, and so having that kind of like economies of scale, really, I think is really important to actually being able to produce it in terms of, you know, both the field, the industry actually being able to develop the housing, and then also ensuring that there's like appropriate regulation. So I think that the statewide route is really exciting for this work. I can kind of go on, but I would say, like, I would just, I feel like the idea of also there being carrots that we're providing. So like that, I think, is a new area of federal policy. Like, we're not going to give you CDBG money unless you're showing that you're actually building more, you know, housing that is not single family, you know, not single family zoned, that kind of thing is really exciting. I also think that, you know, to the discussion about accessory dwelling units, like, one of the reasons why I remain still positive about this is that I also think that, you know, in many cases, we don't really have the capacity to be building housing from the government that we would like. I mean, it would be great if we were building more public housing and if we were, you know, actually able to do that in a way. But in many cases, like, that's not the case. And I don't love the fact that most of the accessory dwelling units are being built by people who already have a tremendous amount of housing equity. And I think that we need to think about, you know, if we're going to have, if we're going to really see accessory dwelling units as this opportunity to be building more, you know, more affordable housing types and get that kind of housing diversity that creates, you know, economic diversity and all sorts of diversity in our neighborhoods and density and so on, we have to think about, like, what are the appropriate financing tools? So it was interesting when Andrew was mentioning the idea of there being like a permanent underclass and that potentially being a problem with the accessory dwelling units. And one of the things that I think is so critical is finding ways to finance the accessory dwelling unit renter into owning that, you know, and getting into some kind of co-op with the primary housing owner, or finding ways for people to buy property with an accessory dwelling unit with the financing taking into account that they're going to rent the main house out. I think that's the new starter home. The new starter home is you living in the accessory dwelling unit, you rent that big house out until you can afford to be, you know, in the big house, and then you rent the small house out. And then maybe, you know, when you're in your 60s or 70s and you're retiring, you rent the big house out again, whatever it might end up being. But I think that kind of thing would help, you know, address what I think is a legitimate concern around the fact that, you know, ADUs, I think, are primarily paid for by people who have the financial savvy, the finances and the savvy to actually be able to build them, not the people who kind of need them and could use them as tools for building equity.
So Andy, you worked for a city housing authority.
That's true.
Single family housing is not really the main huge chunk of, it's not most of New York City's housing. But what do you think about kind of state roles coming in? What do you think about, and you know, just how housing in that context of our super dense city, how is it being redesigned in New York?
Well, Diana correctly identifies the reality that we're not likely to have any new public creation of housing anytime soon. Certainly in New York, the New York City Housing Authority, which is where I was working, cannot imagine the creation of new, certainly cannot imagine the creation of new public housing, period. Can't imagine the creation of new affordable housing without the sort of partnership of private industry. So, yeah, I mean, I think that there's certainly, Diana correctly identifies the reason why I'm not like out here like no ADUs, because it's something and it's better than nothing. And we're not likely to get the thing that would be better, which is simply the public creation of more public housing. Not just for, you know, I'm a believer in the idea that municipalities should be kind of taking the sort of 1930s view of public housing as a sort of public service for, you know, that is not necessarily income restricted or has a much higher kind of maximum bound for, you know, for sort of maximum income, as a way of diversifying, or even the public creation of market rate housing as a tool to finance the creation of housing for people that have less money. None of that is likely to happen in the United States anytime soon, or probably ever. And so, yeah, we totally need to be getting more creative about how we think about the creation of, you know, housing that is affordable. I think that, like, you know, affordable housing tends to have a very specific architectural connotation.
So, Diana, your book investigates, you actually went and lived in, at least overnight, if not, I don't know how long, you know, but you went and visited various new kinds of housing, tiny homes, multi-generational homes, ADUs, garage to residence conversions, eco-villages, even hospital-built housing for the homeless and chronically ill. I mean, so all of these types that are arguably making residents happier, healthier, and just a better fit for what their circumstances are. You point out that the younger generation is just, you know, more into experience than stuff. They spend so much time online that they crave social contact, value social contact a little bit, maybe more than previous generations, and that they enjoy the lifestyle freedom of not owning a home, especially during the pandemic. I can go live here. I can go live there. I can kind of work from home if I'm working remotely. But how much is it that do you think they're really choosing to not own a single family home? Or is it that they're just sort of making the best of the fact that they are saddled with so much student debt that they, and the prices have gone up so sky high, they just can't possibly afford one?
I mean, first of all, obviously you can't speak on behalf of all the members of an entire generation. So, you know, I am certain that there are many different ways in which younger people feel about owning stuff and versus not owning. And certainly I've seen lots of surveys and data about that there's, you know, people would love to own their own homes, they just can't. And so on. I also, though, would say that, you know, there are a lot of other different demographic trends that kind of point to people, you know, a younger generation making sort of lifelong commitments later in life or less frequently. So, you know, the sort of getting married, having kids, buying a house package is much less of a thing now than it was, certainly than it was, you know, in the 1950s, right? There's just much less of this kind of like predictable pattern of what happens to people after they're exiting their 20s. And so as a result of that, I think that there's, you know, not only is there less pressure to get into owning a home, but there may be also less desire to do that, because why buy a house if you're not certain that you're going to be living in that neighborhood for the rest of your life, or not even, you know, the rest of your life, but, you know, 2 years from now. So I think that there's certain ways that it's a combination, right? I think certainly if this were, and what I do see is this kind of younger generation, like I've read a lot about sort of younger people being more focused on figuring out ways to save money to like retire early or focus on their passion careers less than kind of, you know, just working forever. And so instead of just buying a house to live in, buying rental properties to have passive income, I think there's just like a very different vision for people of what home ownership and homes mean. And so I think that is kind of part of it. And I think, you know, just, I would just underscore the fact that the whole point of bringing up these different alternatives to the single family home is acknowledging the ways in which we've had sort of this, you know, orthodoxy of the single family home, and we are a much more diverse and fragmented country than that. And so as a result, we should have many more different types of housing options and pathways for people.
I think that the essence of that kind of diversity is the ability to do what you want to within it. And part of the problem is that, yeah, people my age are getting married less and having kids less because it is, well, certainly getting married is not necessarily expensive, but having kids certainly is, and buying a house certainly is. Like, you know, this is purely anecdotal, but just in my experience, I have a kid in daycare right now. It's rent. I don't know how you could have more than one kid. So there's your declining household size. And yeah, it's basically, you know, prohibitively expensive to buy property. I think that plenty of people want to do it. Certainly, I wish that we could imagine a way in which the creation of wealth is decoupled from property ownership.
Yes.
Because obviously, obviously part of our problem now is the perverse incentives created when property ownership is the primary means of, mm-hmm. of kind of generating wealth in America. Because obviously by, you know, and I'm no economist by any stretch of the imagination, but simple supply and demand, that if you have an asset and there are many more of that asset out there, your asset is going to be worth less. So that's why you end up with, you know, people who will fight against new housing at any cost, because it, you know, they're worried that it's going to lower their property values, and maybe it will. But I think that the problem is then that if your property value gets lowered, then suddenly your retirement is in jeopardy. And that to me is the issue, that like your broader financial health is tied to the value of your home. And that obviously is going to incentivize you to fight against, you know, the lowering of your property value, which would in turn make it possible. If your property value is lower, then it's possible for people that don't have as much money to buy similar property. And so it's this very perverse cycle that is created by, you know, the emphasis on property ownership as the primary means of wealth generation.
And I think it's really important that you brought up, you know, that sort of retirement, because they say that, you know, we spend almost all our entire life savings in the last 6 months of life.
Oh, wow.
That's hospital bills and usually if it's a married couple, the man dies first and the woman is left as a pretty destitute widow. That is the pattern. And if we could fix, so we have to redesign our healthcare system in order perhaps to better redesign. But Diana, you end the book with, I think, a really exciting chapter of just speculating about the alternative models to generational wealth creation. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't been that long. I mean, my grandparents didn't make a killing on their house. Mm-hmm. The point of having a house often was, yes, you wanted to have something, you would pass that on to your children. That was often how having a house was seen as an asset. It was security, but it wasn't this financial wealth kind of thing. I don't know. Tell us more about what some of your proposals or what we need to get out of this cycle.
Yeah, well, so I would just say that, you know, we really spent a century perfecting the mortgage and housing industry as it is, and spent a lot of time figuring out kind of how to kind of build wealth through home ownership. Oftentimes when you look at, you know, various different agendas for creating more racial equity, more, you know, economic equity in this country, home ownership is just constantly put there as like that the solution would be getting more homeowners. That's always the solution for increasing wealth. And I think that there has been just a complete lack of conversation at the thought leadership level, but certainly at the national government level, of kind of thinking about like, well, what could be some other ways to actually generate wealth for people over time that isn't, you know, just housing and isn't just a job? And so I think, you know, in terms of what some of the other options might be, you know, there are very small experiments, I would say, when you look at the vastness of the sort of status quo in terms of things like community land trusts, right? Being able to have the community essentially owning the wealth of the neighborhood, and that kind of releases that valve of the perverse incentives that Andrew was mentioning. And I think could be a really interesting option. You know, there are certain, I would want to give a shout out to folks like Eve Picker, who has Small Change, which is a community, you know, crowdfunding of housing opportunities. So instead of actually having to think about building your wealth, building, you know, owning your single family home, you could actually build wealth by being an investor in developments of multifamily properties and things like that. So trying to find ways in which people could kind of see themselves actually getting invested in projects, you know, hopefully maybe in their neighborhoods, but, or it could be, you know, across the US where you're in, you know, you could be investing in development and actually getting housing built, but it doesn't have to be, you know, your own home. But I think there just needs to be a much broader conversation about this in terms of, you know, recognizing that this is a problem, not just in terms of the fact that there are, you know, racial divides in terms of home ownership rates in the US, but also in terms of who's actually owning homes at this point. I mean, increasingly investors are the ones who are buying and selling housing. And so it's, if you look at it at the long game, if you were to, you know, kind of take these different trends of the numbers of investors owning homes and project it out into 2 decades from now, let's say, you start to see that you'd have something around, you know, a quarter of a given city being owned by investors and not even residents themselves. So then you actually have to seriously start thinking about, you know, what could be ways of ensuring people kind of economic stability. And maybe that's also the way to frame it a little bit more, is thinking about this as economic stability rather than necessarily like wealth creation. So sort of to that point about, you mentioned like the destitute widow and people just sort of being, you know, financially wrecked by health issues. You know, I thought you were going to seg into the conversation about, you know, hospitals building housing, but I really do think that there needs to be a better kind of synthesis between housing and healthcare in terms of recognizing that they are, you know, intricately connected. And that, you know, for a lot of people, like healthcare is a huge cost. And so figuring out ways to create stability through better healthcare or through healthier housing actually is another idea. So yeah, I just think it's like a huge reframing of how we're thinking about people's connection to their housing and their economic stability and their lively stability.
So Andy, what strikes you as the most fertile ground here in our fair city for redesigning the house? What advice would you give your students?
I don't know. I think that Atlanta actually is kind of potentially well positioned to be doing some really amazing work in this regard. As the kind of prototypical sprawling city, there's just kind of a giant canvas on which to actually explore with different typologies if we can get beyond single family zoning. And I think that, you know, there is a movement in the Atlanta DCP seemingly to actually try to, you know, whether on a small or large scale, begin to experiment with different ways that we might kind of inhabit the giant area that is Atlanta. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in terms of what I would say to my students, I've already said everything. We're basically doing this in our studio right now. Imagining how within the kind of urban scale and architectural language of the single family neighborhood, you might begin to inject programmatic diversity is kind of the subject of our studio right now. So we'll see how it goes.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to thank you both for the conversation. I want to now invite the audience to please, I'm going to start looking at the questions. The first thing I'm going to do is tell you the results of the poll. So let's see, 17%, 21% of attendees, and please go ahead and add some more, describe where they live as a detached house for one household. So kind of the standard, only 21% that were in that. A detached house that was subdivided for more than one household, 11%. 16% in a duplex, triplex, quad that was designed for multiple households, but still at the scale. So we have a lot of missing middle here in Atlanta, certainly in Atlanta. I don't know about how much of this is online or here. 11% in a townhouse. We're getting quite a kind of even, fairly even numbers here. But then a whopping, not too surprising, given a college town here, college audience, 26%, that's our majority, are in an apartment or condo in a multifamily building that's bigger than a quote unquote house. Nobody in an apartment or condo in a building that was not originally designed to be residential, although I live in a converted warehouse, so I'm one. And 11% in a small apartment, dorm, room, micro unit, whatever, in a co-living building or dormitory. Nobody in a cottage court. Nobody in a tiny home. 5% in other. Not sure quite which others. Anyway, all right, let's go to Q&A. And I know there were a few people that I think posted comments in the Zoom chat, but I'm going to really just focus on Q&A. First up, it is surprising to notice that the percent of multi-generational living increases as the average household size drops. What is the possible explanation for that? Diana, that's on you.
Oh, that's a good one. I would say that, I mean, I think it's just two different demographic trends, right? So, I mean, you know, even if you have a single family, an increasing number of people who are living as singles, right? So that trend is increasing at the same time, and it's kind of balancing out the multi-generational household size. So that would be my guess of kind of how you end up still seeing that. I would have to run the math a little bit to figure out, you know, exactly, because I think it's generally acknowledged that it's somewhere around 20% of the population is living in multi-generational households, but that's still less than the number of people who are living alone. And so if you kind of, the average household size, I think in 2018 was somewhere around 2.5 people. So it's still more than one, but it's, you know, and also multi-generational households could include like a grandma, a daughter and her son or something like that. You know, that's a multi-generational household and it's only 3 people. So it's not always, lots and lots of people. It could be, you know, even, you know, your typical family of 4 plus a grandparent or something like that.
All right, Andy, I've got one for you here. Most of the one house per day designs answer practical concerns with aesthetically playful solutions. To what extent should this be a priority in real life?
I mean, I think that that's, you know, if you're not into playful solutions, then, you know, don't hire me as your architect. you know, nothing in there is meant to be kind of universal or, you know, a template for, you know, broader.
That's why you have 365 of them.
That's why there are 365. I mean, I think, yeah, of course, some of those are very playful, and maybe some of the more playful ones tend to be less realistic. But I also think that, like, we've become so hemmed in by the way that we think about housing by the sort of standardization that the last couple of that the last century has brought, both in terms of, you know, the programmatic diversity of the house and the, you know, vanishing diversity in kind of, you know, architectural tactics. So yeah, I think that some playfulness is productive, even if, you know, I was actually designing a house, it might have walls that hit the floor.
But so, all right, if I was, if I was at the National Home Builders Association annual meeting that gets like 75,000 people showing up in Las Vegas to find out what is the plan that sold the most last year and ergo will become the plan that is most reproduced in the coming year. So a question that received quite a few likes. Often, property taxes in the suburbs are lower than in the city, and yet the suburbs have better schools. Don't you think we have to start reversing these economics? And how might we begin to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that unfortunately, a lot of the sort of costs of building the suburbs kind of got hidden somewhere, you know, and it's like the true cost of that infrastructure is not necessarily being borne by individual suburban counties. And in a lot of cases, you know, the urban core is the area which has the most of that infrastructure, right? Like they're the ones who are going to have to keep the streets clean around the subway stations and things like that. There's a number of reasons why cities are just more expensive to run. So I think, yes, I agree. Like we do have to more broadly find ways of making dense, walkable, healthy places less expensive, you know, whether that's urban or suburban. I don't think it, you know, matters so much, but I think that the broader problem that this question is sort of bringing up is, you know, why are the places that are, you know, that have good schools, that are pleasant to live in, that are safe, why are these places expensive? And the answer I would contend is that we don't build enough housing in those places. And if we built more housing, there would probably be less expensive housing in those places. And we've got to find a way to do that and also still preserve all the good things that people, you know, the reasons why those are nice places to live in.
And I'm certainly not the first person to argue that low density suburbs require even more infrastructure of street, the physical infrastructure, and their property taxes don't pay for it.
Yeah,
they don't cover it. Chuck Marone calls it a Ponzi scheme. Mm-hmm.
And not to mention that often the city, the municipal government of a city needs to directly actually, expend resources in the service of maintaining the kind of, suburban lifestyle. Absolutely. So like in New York, where I'm coming from, there's an insane amount of like nonstop roadway construction that basically accommodates people driving in from Long Island and, and other suburban locales around the city. So the city, in addition to, you know, all of its other issues, ends up like, as Diana said, like bearing the cost of the lifestyle of the people that live in the suburbs.
So we have a question that was in the Zoom. Can you address the way, and this, Diana, this sort of gets at some of, I think, your interest in the marketing of suddenly calling them tiny homes instead of mobile homes or other, in the book, you go through quite a lot of, calling co-living becomes kind of glamorous as opposed to, SRO, single residence occupancy or boarding houses and things. So can you address the way in which industry has affected our ideals and ambitions for our housing through marketing, commercialism, the proliferation of industries that profit from the expansion of house ambitions, the housing industry complex, if you will?
Yeah. Well, so I definitely think that that is true, that there is a housing industrial complex that is, kind of propping up various different ideals for people. And it's just, it's the same as just say, like, you watch an ad for a car and all of a sudden you're kind of transported and thinking that this car is going to change your life or whatnot. Very similarly, I think that there is ways in which we have ideas of, how housing is going to transform our lives as well. I think for so many years, there have been ways in which we've promoted that kind of single family home ideal. What I'm more aware of is also ways in which we, through language, start to disparage any, you know, the alternatives to that. So like, you know, instead of calling co-living like an amazing community for that people could experience, it gets called adult dorms in the news. Or instead of it being like a multi-generational living situation is a great way for family members to support each other, it's called, doubling up. Children who live at home are, you know, failing to launch. These kinds of, you know, ways in which we just continually provide this image of what a family should be and what a house should be, I think it really kind of intimidates people from thinking about, from just kind of even questioning like how some of these things could be good things. And I think also one of the other things is the US media market is so insular. We have very little idea of how other people live in other places. So, you know, there was, I think, a New York Times article recently about people living in Tokyo in like 95 square feet. And the amount of kind of social media reaction, just talking about like how ridiculous this was. And I saw someone respond and say, like, you all just outed yourself as having absolutely no idea how most of the rest of the world lives and lives perfectly happily in that way. And so I think that like a lot of people are unaware that the dominant way of living outside the US is multi-generationally. Living that in many other countries, living in a dense downtown with a walkable neighborhood is the way that you live and is completely normal and, you know, and valued. So I think that in a way we have closed off those kinds of conversations. And I think we also need to find ways of showcasing other ways of living beyond what ends up happening so often is like kind of like an idealized Northern European version of it when there's just so much else going on in other places in the world.
I know one study, I think a professor at Cornell, you eat a chocolate bar, it makes you happy for about 30 minutes. Buying a McMansion out on the edge, he actually was able to kind of study and calculate and said about 6 months of happiness comes from that. And after that, right, the commute drives you crazy. And right, you're not as happy about, oh, I'm so happy that I have a game room, a mail cave, and a sewing room, and a this, and a that, and, you know,
gift wrapping room.
All that.
The gift wrapping room, I think.
Yes, the gift wrapping room. That should be, yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
Well, I think it's also, Diana, you talk in your book about how morality became part of the sort of lexicon with which housing was talked about, that in the 1900s, housing was just where you lived. But as we kind of got into the early 20th century, the discussion around housing took on moral dimensions. And so, yeah, I think it's not surprising that when you spend a century kind of, you know, claiming that the single family house is not only, you know, more hygienic or has access to better light and air or like objectively measurable things, but is a morally superior way to live. Yeah, it's really tough to kind of like shake out of that.
And that one gets also, that's similar to one of the questions here. How can we assess the validity of the concern for losing privately owned space in existing neighborhoods? What does that transition process look like? People, even though it may be my neighbor's yard,
yeah,
that is getting the ADU, I don't own it. But if it's part of my view, it's part of my bird habitat, people do have concern. Do we validate those concerns? Do we address them? Is anyone doing a good job?
I was just going to say, like, I think that that question kind of comes down to like, you know, why don't we have better planning? If we more adequately planned to kind of, you know, provide at a municipal level the things that people need, like good outdoor space and stuff like that, then we wouldn't need to worry about, you know, whether or not that is being provided by private, by private space, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I also think that, you know, I have many conversations with people who seem to me very educated about a variety of different topics in their city and have had very little conversation about the dynamics of the housing, of building more housing. And, you know, these kinds of conversations that we're having today and sort of like, that's not part of the regular discourse. So I had a friend tell me about an enormous development going up in her neighborhood that is right next to the train station, and how concerned she was about this and the parking issues that it was going to create and the fact that it was going to be huge and the light and the air. And it was just like, wow, you are bringing up all these, you know, concerns. And it's like, I just need to have, you know, half an hour talking to you about like the pros and the cons of the situation. And I think ultimately it kind of reminds me of the situation with COVID, which is like, are you wearing a mask for yourself? Are you wearing a mask to be part of all of us wearing a masks, all of us wearing masks so that we're able to kind of have bring COVID cases down, right? Like, you know, in the very beginning and whatnot. And so I think that like, are we building housing? We have to think about why we're building the housing in the first place, because it's not just your concerns about your own backyard. It's about the fact that we're going to have another tens of millions of people living in this country. And if we don't build housing for them, what's going to happen? It's going to be a lot worse than having, you know, an accessory dwelling unit in your backyard. It's going to be a lot worse than that. So I think that people really need to kind of get educated about, you know, give and take that is necessary here. It's not just about you and your own situation.
On that note of more education, I very much want to thank Diana Lynn and Andrew Bruno. You've been listening to episode 27 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. A video and podcast of this event will be posted to our website, arch.gatech.edu/redesigning-cities. And that's also where you can check out previous episodes.